This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, it's a pleasure for me to have on the show Anne Wright, the retired colonel, self-retired State Department official, who is outspoken about the Iraq War. She's also outspoken about the Afghanistan War, and even more outspoken about Israel's occupation policy and U.S. policy toward Israel, for that matter. She's the co-editor of a book called Dissent, Voices of Conscience, Government Insiders Speak Out Against the War in Iraq. And she's doing tremendous activism these days. Anne Wright, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you.
Tell me a little bit about yourself and where you grew up.
Well, I grew up in Arkansas, and that was the reason I joined the Army. I wanted to get out of Arkansas, so that started my military career that lasted 29 years, 13 in the active Army and 16 in the reserves. And
were your parents in the military?
Well, my dad was in World War II, but it wasn't like we were a family of a great military history. It was an opportunity for me to get out of Arkansas and travel, and it just had happened to be through the vehicle of the military. It wasn't I joined to go kill anybody or anything like that, but like most young kids, it's a mechanism to either get a job, some skills, to travel, and that's what I used it for.
See the world, join the Army. That used to be their slogan. So
join the Army, see the world.
And tell me what it was like to be in the Army. What was your experience like?
Well, mine was very good. I had very good leadership in the units that I was in, very minimal harassment, you know, being a minority, a real minority as a woman in the military. Less than 1% of the military was women when I joined, and now it's up to like 15%.
And you weren't confronted with really nasty sexism or anything worse?
No, I was not, and I feel very lucky and fortunate, and that's why I ended up staying for so long, is because I had a good experience. But unfortunately, a lot of women don't. In fact, right now, the statistics are that 1 in 3 women are sexually assaulted or raped while they're in the military, and the sexual harassment is up around 90%.
And that's appalling. And that's by the assaults or by their own, by men in the service.
Yes, yes.
Which is just appalling. And what is the military doing on that? Do you know?
Well, yes. I've done a lot of writing about this subject, and while they have programs for the prevention of it, it's not working. It's the attitude of, it's the culture that has to change, and the senior leadership of the Army is not, in my opinion, doing what needs to be done, which is holding people accountable for criminal acts. If you look at the prosecution of people in the military that are being accused of these crimes, and even if they're convicted, the punishment is just very minor. So it lends the feeling that you can get away with these sorts of crimes.
And that tells the women in the service, if they're assaulted, that you might as well shut up because there's nothing going to happen about it. And if they're assaulted by a superior, it's even more difficult.
That's right.
When did you leave the military?
Well, I retired from the military in 1996, but by that time I'd left active duty, was in the reserves, and then I had joined up with the State Department in 1987 and ended up being in the State Department for 16 years before I resigned in March of 2003 in opposition to the war in Iraq.
Why did you join up with the State Department?
Well, having been traveling with the military for so long and working in positions that we had a lot of dealings with our U.S. embassies in various parts of the world, I took a look at the what the State Department was doing and its role and thought, you know, I think I'd like to have a broader view of what's going on rather than just the military aspect of our U.S. foreign policy. So I took the Foreign Service exams and then eventually was offered a position just about the time that I was really having some I was ready to get out of the military because the military wasn't letting me do what I wanted to do. And
And what was that?
Well, it was to join the Defense Attaché program. And this was back in the middle 80s. And it turned out that the military had never opened that career field up to women. And when I applied for it and got this little nasty note back from the Department of the Army saying, well, thank you very much, but we don't have women in the Defense Attaché field. Women can't work in male-dominated countries, macho countries of Central and South America and the Middle East and all that. Women can't work in these positions. And I just completed 3 years of working with the U.S. Southern Command in Panama and traveled all over Central and South America and done fine. So I was very irritated to get that response back. And when I had a job offer from the State Department at the same time, I took it.
And where did you go? What were some of your posts in the State Department, Ann Wright?
In the State Department, I was in Nicaragua, Grenada, Somalia, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Sierra Leone, Micronesia. Then I helped reopen the U.S. Embassy in Kabul, Afghanistan in December of 2001, stayed there for 5 months, and then went on to what turned out to be my last assignment, which was Deputy Ambassador for the U.S. Embassy in Mongolia.
I'm speaking with Ann Wright. She was one of the three Foreign Service officers who retired publicly right before the Iraq War because they saw the disaster coming. And she's been very outspoken since on that in Afghanistan and Israel, Palestine. She's the co-editor of Dissent, Voices of Conscience, Government Insiders Speak Out Against the War in Iraq. Let's talk about Afghanistan for a bit. You were in favor of the Afghanistan war. What were your reasons for that, and how do you view the war now?
Well, I wasn't necessarily in favor of it. I was amazed that the Bush administration chose to actually put first CIA and then U.S. military into Afghanistan, knowing the history of Afghanistan, where the shelf life of invaders is pretty short. I was really amazed that the Bush administration decided that it was going to go after Al-Qaeda and bin Laden by putting a lot of Americans in there. The Clinton administration, who had been after bin Laden ever since the Khobar Towers bombing in Saudi Arabia in 1995, and then the blowing up of two U.S. embassies in East Africa in 98, and then the bombing of the USS Cole in Yemen in 2000. The response by the Clinton administration had been to send cruise missiles into training sites in Afghanistan. And, of course, that's a pretty heavy-handed way to go after people using cruise missiles. But I think it was an acknowledgement that getting involved in on the ground in Afghanistan was a strategy fraught with problems. And for the Bush administration to go ahead and send in people to Afghanistan, by December, I was looking at what was happening and thinking, well, I would like to kind of see how this is working out. I'd been in Afghanistan 30 years before, traveling through, at that point in 1972, you could travel all the way from Europe, travel through Turkey, through Iran, you know, because that was prior to the revolution there. You could go through Afghanistan, you could get into Pakistan, then you had to fly across the Pakistani border into India. So I'd been on that whole route 30 years before, and I wanted to go see what this was all about. Though the five of us that reopened the U.S. embassy were of the opinion that the U.S. presence, a military presence in Afghanistan, had a shelf life of about 3 years. That if the Taliban had been moved out, if Al-Qaeda was not in Afghanistan, there was a window of opportunity that you could help the people of Afghanistan that had been pounded by war for the last 25 years with the Soviet invasion, then the Soviets being kicked out, and then the Mujahideen then becoming known as warlords as they fought among themselves for territory and resources in Afghanistan, and then the Taliban pushing them out. So for 25 years, the people of Afghanistan had a tough life. And I was thinking, well, maybe these, helping to build some schools, helping to do clinics, trying to, if things were quiet, there was a way that you could help people in Afghanistan. But as it turned out, the focus of the Bush administration really wasn't on Afghanistan. It switched very, very quickly to Iraq. And while I was still in Afghanistan in January of 2002, when President Bush gave his State of the Union message, with Hamid Karzai sitting up in the upper reaches of the U.S. Congress watching the State of the Union message, where he thought the focus of the U.S. was on Afghanistan, but when President Bush said there are other areas of the world, there is an axis of evil, Iran, Iraq, North Korea, you can see in Hamid Karzai's face this kind of like, uh-oh, what's going on here? And that's what we thought in Kabul, Afghanistan, when we were hearing this State of the Union message, what's going on? And it triggered a diversion of resources from Afghanistan into Iraq that meant that I think that we just lost the window of opportunity, and it has closed now, in my opinion.
So what is your reaction then, given that the window's closed and Obama has escalated U.S. presence, they're doubling or tripling the number of troops. Mm-hmm. What's the consequence of that, do you think?
Well, it is another part of U.S. heavy-handedness, where the image of the United States around the world just keeps going deeper and deeper into the toilet. I mean, when you have 120,000 U.S. troops now, you have 80,000 U.S. contractors in Afghanistan, you've got 40,000 NATO troops that are training, 300,000 Afghan army troops, 250,000 Afghan police, nearly 800,000 people now in Afghanistan to make it a very secure and stable place. And by our own intelligence estimates, there are at a big day for al-Qaeda, there might be 50 al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. And when there's no other work at all for farmers and all, and the Taliban comes through to say, okay, boys, dig up your weapons. We're going to go out and shoot some Americans. They might get 15,000. So you have 15,050 insurgents, enemy, or whatever you want to call them, against 800,000 well-equipped, reasonably well-trained troops. And so what's happened? Well, it's a very unstable country. So I would say this policy of increasing the number of troops in Afghanistan has not worked at all. And in fact, it was against the recommendations of President Obama's own ambassador in Afghanistan, who is a retired three-star army general who had served two tours in Afghanistan. And when the strategy sessions on Afghanistan were underway, and when he sent in his three cables, which subsequently were leaked to the American public, his recommendation was no more military troops. There is no military solution to this.
I'm speaking with Anne Wright. She used to be in the State Department. She's a retired Army colonel. She retired from the State Department publicly, along with two other colleagues, in the lead-up to the Iraq War. I just reread your courageous letter of resignation to Secretary of State Colin Powell. I want to get your mindset right before you wrote it. This must have been an agonizing decision. You'd worked for the U.S. government, as you said in the letter, your whole adult life in the military, and then with the State Department. How did you come to that, what must have been wrenching decision?
Well, it wasn't that I had drunk the Kool-Aid on the eight different presidential administrations that I had worked under, starting with Lyndon Johnson when I joined the military, and then ending with George Bush. I mean, there were plenty of policies and programs that each one of these administrations cooked up that I thought were, oh my God, how in the world could anyone possibly do this? But as a career, either military or foreign service officer, your job is to implement these programs. And you can compartmentalize your thoughts on them. You can try to get away from policies you don't agree with and or think are harmful, and find other policies you can and programs you can work on. And that's the way I had survived being in the government. But for this decision to invade and occupy an oil-rich Arab Muslim country that had not attacked the United States, and for which the Bush administration was unable to get the authorization of the UN Security Council for military operations to protect the international community. I mean, there was no legal basis for this. The UN didn't believe George Bush's and Colin Powell's description of the weapons of mass destruction. They refused to authorize military operations. And with that, it was an illegal operation in my mind. And I felt it was really going to be so harmful for U.S. relationships with the world. And, of course, terrible, the numbers, the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Iraqis that were going to get killed or wounded by this horrible thing called war, that I felt that my my voice, I mean, I was not about to be a part of that administration, and that once I resigned, then I had the freedom as a private citizen to speak out using my background, both in the military and the Foreign Service, to criticize policies of the administration, which I've been doing. And I'm an equal opportunity criticizer. I've criticized the Bush administration, and I'm criticizing the Obama administration.
Yeah, you've been doing a great job of it, Anne Wright. You wrote, I believe in your book, Dissent, Voices of Conscience, that you wrapped yourself in a blanket, a couple nights, five nights in a row, and just started to write down your ideas about why you thought this impending Iraq war was bad as you were starting to compose this letter, I suppose.
Well, that's right. By the time, finally, that last day when it was either you resign or you just shut up, hold your nose, and keep going. And I was in Mongolia. It was a Mongolian winter. It was colder than could be. Oh my God. And I was waking up at 2 a.m. I couldn't sleep. You know, it was really affecting my ability to operate. I mean, I had to make a decision one way or the other. And I'd wake up, put big blankets around, you know, and get a cup of coffee and start writing. By the time all this finished, I had a stack probably a foot high of various drafts of my concerns. And finally, on March 19th, I did the final draft, walked into the embassy and took my cable to the communications officer and said, please send this through what's called the dissent channel. So it bypasses our ambassador, it bypasses our own embassy, all the chain of command, all the bureaucracy, and lands straight on Colin Powell's desk. Mm. And the communication officer kind of looked at it, read it, and went, oh, my goodness, you can't do this. And I said, no, I've made my decision. Mm. Please go ahead and send it. And about 20 minutes later, she came back and said, I think you ought to relook this. You know, there might be some mistakes in it that you might. And I said, no, you go ahead and send it just as it is. And she said, I really don't want to do this. Mm-hmm. And so I walked her back to the communications area and said, I'm standing here until you send this. It has to be done right now. And she finally sent it off, and then that was the end of my Foreign Service career.
It must have been a relief, though. Or what were your reactions when it did?
No, it was a relief. It was like, okay, finally, I mean, this is done. I've made my decision, and I let the chips fall where they may. And very quickly, within my own embassy, I then went into the ambassador's office and said, I've just now resigned over this. And he was just floored. Mm. I mean, he didn't really agree, I don't think, with what was going to be happening. But he was an ambassador. You know, he put in his many, many years. And he was sticking with it. So he was floored. And then I sent an email out to all the rest of the people in our embassy saying that I have resigned, and the ambassador will be picking who he wants to take my job until somebody else can come in. Well, I'll tell you, just all hell broke loose. I mean, people were just coming in going, well, they were coming in going, yeah, you did the right thing. We're sorry to lose you, but this is horrible. You know, and then the bombs were starting to fall in Baghdad, and we had the TVs on, and we were watching what was happening. And one of the staff members immediately got a copy of this, of my letter of resignation, and put it out on the State Department email system. So I think before Colin Powell probably knew about it, people all over the world were reading about it and sending me letters or emails saying, you've done the right thing. I had over 400 emails within 2 days from people in embassies all over the world saying, you've done the right thing. I wish I could have done it, but I've got kids in college. I've got mortgages. I can't do it, but I'm going to work within the system to try to soften the effects of this.
Well, that must have been very gratifying for you. Anne Wright is my guest today. She is the co-editor of a book called Dissent, Voices of Conscience, where she tells about this occurrence. And she's been very outspoken on the Iraq War, Afghanistan, Israel, and Palestine, which we're going to get to soon. Did you ever get a reaction from Secretary of State Paul?
Yes, about 3 days later, there was a cable that came back that said, thank you for your service, both in the military and the State Department, and we wish you well. I found out later, as I went back through Washington and talked to various people, that that short little statement had had many, many variations off of it, that within the bureaucracy, somebody had to write up Colin Powell's thing. He doesn't do that himself, you know. So the bureaucracy apparently initially sent up this scathing little thing like, you're an idiot, and of course we know what we're doing on this war, and da-da-da-da-da. And Colin Powell sent that back saying, no, that's not what I want to tell her. And another version came up, which was, no, that's not it. And then I guess finally, he himself probably said, just write down these words. Thank her very much. Thank you for your service. We wish you well. Goodbye. And that's what came back.
Have you had any encounter with him since?
Yes. I was in the far reaches of an auditorium where he was giving a speech in Palo Alto, California, about 4 years ago. He was making his $100,000 a speech thing, and I was in the back, and when he said, you know, I've this war in a, I mean, it's really a gratuitous speech. He gives the same speech that talks about his life as a retired person driving his red Corvette, and here people have paid $100,000 to get that man to come in to talk, they think, about foreign policy and the decision-making and, you know, the traumas of this. And yet he blithely goes through this stuff of red Corvettes. Well, I was in the back of the room, and he finally starts saying, you know, when I was Secretary of State, and I thought, well, this is my opportunity. And I said, when you were Secretary of State, I was a diplomat, and I resigned because you didn't have the nerve to resign, that you should have resigned, and that would have stopped this war in Iraq that's been so destructive to everyone. Well, that's about all I got out before the guards were on me to haul me out of there. So that's the only encounter I've had with Colin Powell.
And how do you summon the guts to do that? You did it there. You've done it in the Senate when Condoleezza Rice was testifying. You got up and said, stop the killing, and you got hauled out of there, too. So I'm just wondering how you find the courage to do that.
Well, and culturally, I mean, my old background was certainly not standing up and yelling and things. I was, you know, a staid diplomat and all this stuff. It has been by working with other people who've spent a lifetime in social justice issues, who are willing to confront authority figures and power figures, and who have taught me that, you know, it doesn't hurt, that it may be a little embarrassing, and you're scared to death. There's no doubt about that when you stand up in a congressional hearing and say, don't confirm William Haynes as a federal court judge. He's a torturer. He's part of the torture memos. Don't confirm him as a federal judge. And you do it only when you want to make sure that the decision makers are hearing voices of the people, and that when the decision makers aren't asking the hard questions, and when you as a citizen think, my God, why in the world aren't they asking this guy about this or that? And is it important that these things come up? And is it important that the Senate or the House know that the citizens are watching them? And so you stand up and, oh my God, you know, your heart's beating, you think you're going to faint right there, and then all of a sudden you've got to know what you're going to say, because you have a short period of time to say it, and you don't want to look like a total idiot. I mean, plenty of people are going to say you're an idiot for standing up and yelling. I try not to yell in a very loud voice, though. But when you stand up and you say that, and then you need to know what you're going to be saying as you're hauled out of the room, because you don't want to go just silently. I mean, you will have to have something to be saying to them as you're getting hauled out. But it doesn't last a long period of time, less than a minute. And for the safety and security of our country, I think everyone can do that confrontation to authority for a minute of your life.
That's a nonviolent way to protest. It takes courage that you've gotten spades, Ann Wright. Another thing you've done that demonstrated your courage and your principle is to oppose Israel's occupation of Palestinian land and the embargo and blockade of Gaza. You were on that flotilla that the Israelis raided. You weren't on the boat that was raided, but tell me about that.
Well, all six ships of the Gaza flotilla were forcefully attacked by the Israelis, and all of them had percussion grenades shot by commandos into the windows, blowing out windows. People on each one of those vessels were tasered. They were hit with paint bullets. But it was on board the Mavi Marmara, the 600-passenger ship from Turkey, where the Israeli military used lethal force and ended ended up killing 9 activists, 1 American, Furgan Dugan, a 19-year-old, shot twice to the head, 3 other gunshots to his body, 4 other people executed with shots to their head, a total of 35 bullets found in the 9 bodies. 50 other people were wounded. It was a bloodbath on there. There were no weapons that the passengers had on board. The ships and the passengers were all inspected by international inspectors before they left their ports, because we knew that, of course, the Israelis were concerned that they didn't want ships coming in as gun runners, and that was not, we were not doing that, and we wanted it from the very beginning be known that we were not carrying anything. And in fact, if Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency, is as good as it says it is, they had Mossad agents, I'm sure, that were already on board those boats. We know that 2 of the boats, one of the ones that I was on, was sabotaged. Its steering mechanisms were tinkered with. Both of them failed 12 hours off Crete.
So, no, the Israeli government has still not accepted any responsibility for this and hasn't been held accountable.
No, and our own government, the Obama administration, is protecting the Israelis as each administration does in its criminal acts. And the 14 American passengers on board the ship have written to Secretary of State Clinton with our outrage and our total outrage that the U.S. government is not conducting its own investigation on the murder of an American citizen. And of much lesser importance is the pressure to put on the Israeli government for the return of our cameras, cell phones, and computers that have the evidence of really what happened on board that ship.
Yeah, if another government from another country had killed a U.S. citizen, you can bet that the U.S. government's response would have been a lot more vigorous.
Well, that's right. I mean, if you think back into the 70s when the tragedy of the PLO going on to the Achille Lauro ship in the Mediterranean and an American citizen pushed overboard, horrible things. And there, by golly, there was an outrage on that the U.S. government went after the PLO on that. But you don't see the same thing with the U.S. Going after, to say to the Israelis, we're going to investigate this and we want somebody held accountable. And it's the same thing. Right now, there's a civil trial going on in Haifa on the murder of another American, Rachel Corrie, 7 years ago, as she was run over by an Israeli bulldozer driver. Finally, there's a civil trial going on in Haifa where the bulldozer driver finally had to appear in court, but behind a screen. But that's as far as they've gotten. But it has not been because the U.S. government has been saying to the Israelis, if you don't stop these criminal acts, we're going to stop the $3 billion we give you every year. If you don't comply with international laws on your conduct, we're going to withhold this money, that we will no longer protect you at the peril of our own national security.
And right, we've got about a minute left. Why is it so important in your mind to end the embargo on Gaza?
Well, the embargo is collective punishment of 1.5 million people that live in Gaza. It's a brutal, inhumane, illegal act, and it generates violence toward Israel. That there are young militants who are firing these unguided rockets, and you could only imagine, you know, if you were in the city of Madison or half the city of Madison, and you hadn't been able to get out of there for 4 years, and there was a blockade around it, and you had to dig under these lakes to get food to be brought in. I mean, you'd probably be sending rocks and rockets and everything else. It's not in Israel's best security interest to keep this blockade on.
And you're going to be going back on another ship.
We are fundraising for a U.S. ship to Gaza called the Audacity of Hope, right in the administration's face. And the flotilla, which will probably be 10 to 12 ships, will be going in mid-March.
That's got a familiar ring to it. Anne Wright, thanks so much for being my guest. You can find out more about Anne Wright at voicesofconscience.com or ustogaza.org. It's been great talking with you.
Thank you, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.